in the business world, we figure out how to practice the skills to help us be our very best. And in your industry, I would imagine being present, being able to listen, being able to be non-reactive, to work with the stress of other people, to regulate your own emotions, to regulate your own activation level, and to be calm, to be confident, to be kind.
Welcome to the Press One for Nick podcast. My name is Nick Limsdahl. My guest this week is Dr. Michael Gervais. Michael is a world-leading high-performance psychologist and author, renowned for his 20-year career working with top athletes and organizations. He's a sought-after expert in the mental aspects of peak performance, and his clients are no joke. They include Super Bowl champions, Olympians, Fortune 50 CEOs, and Dr. Gervais also hosts the highly successful and highly recommended Finding Mastery podcast. It already has over 25 million downloads, which is pretty awesome. And his new book, The First Rule of Mastery, published by the Harvard Business Review Press, was released just a month ago, and it's already the number one new release in occupational organizational popular psychology. Dr. Gervais also offers an online course called Finding Your Best and co-created the Performance Science Institute at the USC Marshall School of Business. So without this podcast being how awesome you are, welcome to the Press One for Nick podcast.
Oh, I'm stoked to be here with you, Nick. Thank you for the kind introduction.
Yeah, you bet. So let's talk about, I had the opportunity to kind of read your book, and, you know, it's awesome. And we could spend another day and a half kind of digging into it. But I picked a handful of questions that I think are, you know, will catch the eye or catch the ear of my listener. And, you know, the first thing I want to start off is this acronym FOPO, or fear of others people's opinions. So maybe do a quick intro what that is and the impact it has on personal growth and well-being.
Awesome. So the title of the book is The First Rule of Mastery, and the subtitle is Stop Worrying About People's Thoughts, or Stop Worrying About What People Think of You. And I'll tell you how this came to be, and then I'll define FOPO for you.
Yeah.
Is that I wrote an article on HBR a couple of years ago, and they called me 12 months after, and they said, hey, that article you wrote, it was the number one downloaded article for 12 months in a row. And so it touched a nerve. And what it touched a nerve on was this idea of FOPO, fear of people's opinions. And so essentially, we are social animals. It's normal to care what other people think of us. FOPO moves beyond caring to an unproductive obsession, an unproductive worrying. It's a preemptive process to gain approval or avoid rejection, and it consumes a huge amount of our internal resources. It's like having a bunch of files open on your desktop. That's what FOPO is, a preemptive process to gain approval or avoid rejection in the eyes of others.
So maybe take another step back. We're just going to keep going backwards. You know, did you struggle with that in the past, or what made you want to write about it when it came to that article?
Yeah. So when I was 16 years old, it was the first moment that I realized that I cared a lot about what people thought of me. And it's normal for a teenager to have those types of feelings. And I didn't like it. I was embarrassed that I was shape-shifting to be liked by other people. And that is part of our job at that age, is to figure out who we are and to be that person to our best ability. But to figure out who we are, we're trying to figure out, am I rock and roll? Am I punk rock? Am I country? What's my thing? And I was so embarrassed about it, I didn't talk about it. And then as I started following my career path, you know, eventually as a licensed psychologist with a specialization in sport and high performance, and I'm sitting with some of the world's best, they too had it, and they didn't really talk about it. And the way it shows up for them is, I just don't want to let people down. I don't want to look stupid. It's hard for me to go for it, you know, because like, it's hard to be coached by some of these folks that are so aggressive and critical, and let alone making a mistake in millions of people, I feel tight. And so I felt the same thing as a 16-year-old kid. I just felt tight when other people were just looking at me. And I was making up a story about what they might be thinking of me. So that's in essence what the worry was about. I was worried about what they might be thinking of me. I don't really know what they're thinking of me. And again, come to find out, so many of the world's best that I've spent time with have wrestled and are wrestling with that same thing. And the trifecta, if it hit a nerve on HBR, then I think that, you know, it was worth investigating the science behind it. And so that's how it started.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if I think of my four-year-old doesn't have FOBO at the least bit, but the older you get, you start running into this FOPO. What switches in somebody's mind where they need to start, where they start flexing on that that nerve, and what should they do about it to not do that, to reach that full potential, like you mentioned?
Well, what happens is that FOPO, in essence, shapes the choices that we make or we don't make. It's the, you know, it's the partners that we choose or don't choose. It's the life that we lead that is, you know, at peril here, because the fear of people's opinions gets right down into how we show up in the world and how we either back ourselves or we're trying to be liked by another person. So how do we, your question is like, how do we work with it? It starts with awareness. And once you become aware, it's a little annoying because it's a bit like, it is the air that we breathe, the water that we're swimming in. It is so foundational and fundamental to survival that, and I'll explain the biology in a minute, that it is, it's just the fabric of how social animals work. And we are social animals, we're social beings. And so how do we work with it? The first step is to be aware of it. And maybe for some of your community folks, or folks in your community that are fully enlightened, this is not a book for them. If they are sociopaths, it's probably not a book for them either. So for the rest of us, you know, it's something that we're trying to figure out. Where do we fit? How do we fit? Do I belong? Do I matter in the eyes of others? Here's why it's so powerful. A couple hundred thousand years ago, you and I were in the tribe. And if we screwed up, if we underperformed, if we are a distraction to, you know, the health of the tribe, the elders are going to pull us aside or publicly say, hey, Nick, Mike, you guys, like, I don't know what you're doing. You're on warning now. And we're like, well, whoa, okay. And if we stay with the same behavior, so that should increase some fear. Like, whoa, am I getting kicked out here? Because getting kicked out was a near death sentence. And so if we actually got kicked out, maybe you've got a spouse and I've got an uncle and a cousin and a couple, you know, whatever friends, and we're all kind of this mini little tribe and we all get bounced out. They're like, oh, if you're getting bounced out, I'm going with you. Now there's eight of us, let's say. It's too much to fend, to forge, to fight, to hunt, to gather, to take care of each other from, you know, the stalking saber-tooths and wildebeest to the warring tribes. It's too much. We need the power of the tribe to survive. So getting kicked out, getting rejected is a near death sentence. And that was true 200,000 years ago-ish, but it's not necessarily true now. But the mechanism of the ancient brain is still wired to tap in, to try to figure out if we're okay in the eyes of others. So that's what's happening. Ancient brain, modern times, and the crux of it is this obsession about what are they thinking of me? Because if they don't like me, man, that's tapping into some primal stuff of being kicked down the tribe. And then it's completely flamed with social media, with this obsession of performance and how we look and how we rank in the eyes of other people. And so the path through it is awareness. That's the first pass. The second path through is, actually, let me pause on awareness. There are three best practices, according to research, that help increase awareness. And then you say, becoming aware of what? Well, aware of your thoughts, aware of your feelings, aware of your emotions. So that's aware of your inner life. And being aware of how your thoughts and emotions work. When thought one and two and three, you know, when you're entertaining those thoughts, what emotions, you know, naturally extend. And until you become aware of how your inner life works, you end up getting whipped around by the external world. So awareness is of your internal world, thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And then also awareness of your external world. And when you become more aware of the triggers for certain thoughts, let's say, and the extension of those thoughts, which is the emotional experience that you're having, when you become aware of them, you can do something with them. If you're unaware, it's like you're just in the rapids of life and it's overwhelming. It feels like you have to think, move, do faster than maybe you're trained or capable of, kind of the fear of the rapids, if you will. And what ends up taking place for folks is that so unsettling and uncomfortable that we end up looking outside of ourselves to blame why we feel the way we feel. So we look out at other people, say, well, if you'd only have your shit together, and if this person wasn't so rude to me, and if that person wasn't so cold, or like if somebody would just pick up my call or whatever it is, we look outside of ourselves for the unsettledness that happens within. And so I'm just highlighting the importance of working from the inside out, of increasing your awareness. And there's three practices to increase it. Mindfulness, it's been around 2,600 years, and modern research on it is compelling. Happy to talk about the research, but mindfulness is a best practice. Journaling helps you become more aware of your inner life. And thirdly, conversations with people of wisdom. So the first order of business is like, is this a thing for you? Second is increase your sense of awareness. And then third is to examine this thing of a performance-based identity. Do you have an identity that is wrapped in how well you do what you do? And if you're not sure how to answer that question, how do you fare when you have the opportunity to go and do public speaking? Is it nerve-wracking? Is it overwhelming? Is it a fear? Or is it something that you really are honored to be able to have that experience? You feel very grounded. There's an eloquence in how you share your ideas because you've been given the opportunity to have that forum to share the way that you see the world or the way you understand something. So those are miles apart, that grounded, grateful opportunity, as opposed to, man, the anxiety that comes with walking up those four steps to be in a public forum. There's a reason for most people that public speaking or being in the spotlight is so overwhelming. It is not because, you know, in row 16, there's somebody with a machete or a sniper or a handgun that is just waiting for you to make a mistake. That's not how this works. The most dangerous thing in audiences is their thoughts. Yeah. What do they think of me? Are they going to kick me out or are they going to love me? And if we're playing life according to the approval from others, we end up living life on their terms, not our own. So as much as this is a science-based approach of like, why do we worry so much about other people's opinions? There are very practical tools in the book about how to free yourself from it and still be a good contributor to society, you know? Last point here, Nick, is that the subtitle of the book is not stop caring about what people think. The subtitle is stop worrying. And that's something that is a constrictor to what you are really capable of in this life.
So it's the action from the realizing or the unpredictability of what other people think of you, potentially, right? Like,
yes. Yeah, 100%. And when you say that, do you mean, I'm not sure if they're going to accept me or reject me. So I need to ramp up the attending to being favorable in their eyes. Is that how you're thinking about it?
Yeah, it's exactly what I was thinking. Or no, if I was going up to, if I'm jumping up on stage, I've told the story before, but I'll say it again, is my very first time I was up public speaking was in seventh, eighth grade, something like that. And I was so nervous. And so nervous for what? And I think it was the mindset shift that I have to do this instead of I get to. It's not an opportunity. It's not an excitement. It's not I get to share what I know. It's I'm freaking out and I got my palms are sweaty, my ears are red, and I get up there and I try to say one word and I burped and farted at the same time. So it was the worst thing that could ever
happen. Oh my God, that is hilarious.
Yeah. So it was beyond embarrassing. And I promise never to be in front of a video or in front of public speaking at all. And look where we're at today. So, you know, I think the one thing I wanted to ask you, I think there's a lot around journaling and mindfulness, which I wish we had time for. But if somebody's getting up to the plate or it's the fourth quarter in the red zone and they know that the quarterback, it's up to them to make that official play or the wide receiver to catch that play, or for that matter, taking those four steps. What are the things that you tell your students or your clients to do in those moments to have that peace? And maybe it is that acknowledging, but I'd love to hear that.
Well, so we'll step back one level to frame it. And the framing is that the best in the world, fill in the blanks, could be sport, arts, business, could be anything, right? Like, but those that are either the best or are pursuing being their very best, there are very specific skills that all of us can get better at. And if you break it down into three main buckets, the main buckets are increasing your craft, the skills of your craft, like the essence of what it is that you do. You can train your body, so your physical carriage, so that it supports you in the thing that you do. And for most of us, we're professional sitters. We sit all day. And if our hips are tight and our mid-back kind of has that curve and our shoulders come forward, it's a very expensive body to be in, because the hunched over posture is a protective posture. And it sends a signal to the brain that maybe there's danger in the world. So you think about a fighter's posture. They're hunched over, their chin is down, their shoulders are slightly forward, and their fists are up. That's like the posture of many of us, except we're typing. So yes, we don't have fists, we just have our fingers loose on the keyboard. And that sends a signal to the signal to the brain that there might be danger in the world. So that keys up an entire like mechanism of like scan the world for danger, recognize that dangers might be looming, and it's very expensive to be in that body. So it's train your craft, train your body. And for professional sitters, it's about like having, you know, good posture basically. And then you can train your mind. So the best in the world, go back to your sport analogy, they train all three prior to the event, prior to being tested, prior to quote unquote, that moment that you're talking about, the red zone or being over the plate. And then when you're on the plate, your job is to trust. That's the essence of it. Trust that you'll figure out, however this is going to go, you'll figure out the next step, whether it's a abject failure or it's a wonderful success, you'll figure either of those out. And so the essence is to get to a place of trust. Now, how do you trust yourself? That's a different question. And so what I'm doing in the moment, I'm sorry, when athletes are in those moments, is I'm reminding them that they have everything they need to figure it out. It's an interesting problem. It's a problem that you're asking to try to solve. It's rare. It's hard. Go figure it out. You know, like go trust yourself, back yourself. And if you feel like you're too keyed up, breathe. And if you feel like you're doubting yourself, go back to that productive, positive, quote unquote, self-talk. So self-talk and breathing are the two main mechanisms to navigate high stress. But that's just like the sprinkles on top. It's all the work of mental training that they do prior to that gives them the ability to use those tools. Mental imagery, meditation, journaling, conversations with people of wisdom, like psychologists or sports psychologists, self-talk, and. So when the moment's happening, trust yourself, go get free, have fun. You know, I'm basically nodding my head like you got it in you, but they're relying on their entire body of work, and that however it goes, they'll figure that out too.
Yeah, the one thing I like about that too is that they've trained so hard to get to where they're at. Regardless if it's professional or a professional baseball player, NFL player, hockey player, or a keynote speaker, they've trained to take the steps that they are to get to the moment that they're in today. And
that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what's different about business and sport is like, how do we train for business?
Yes, exactly.
You know, sport, it's very concrete. Matter of fact, you know, at amateur sport, there's like one coach for say 8 athletes. In elite sport, it's kind of like one coach for 3 athletes.
Yeah.
And I want to pull on this for a minute, because it is really important that in the business world, we figure out how to practice the skills to help us be our very best. And in your industry, I would imagine being present, being able to listen, being able to be non-reactive, to work with the stress of other people, to regulate your own emotions, to regulate your own activation level, and to be calm, to be confident, to be kind. All of those are trainable skills. Kindness is trainable. Arousal regulation is trainable. Emotional regulation is trainable. Being present is trainable. And so that is something that is like the rite of passage to be your very best, is to invest in that work. The work is not complex. Humans are complex, but the work is not complex. And so I would point to like take a page from where world sport is right now. And they're about 15 years ahead of world business. And if you look at how they organize their life, they invest in training their mind. That's something that we can all do. And so in this book, there are some practices there, but there's other resources as well, of course.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What I do appreciate, the MLB, there's individual performance coaches, NFL, there is as well. NHL, I think they're spotty, but they are there. You think of like Nathan MacKinnon back in 2017 said that he's talking to a sports psychologist. Like 2017, that was the first time I ever heard of it. But if they're talking about it, why shouldn't corporate America be talking to a psychologist as well to remove that self-talk, that self-doubt, and to perform at their best, that peak performance? And I feel like they are stuck in that whirlwind, those rapids, and they don't know how to get out. And the one question I had was kind of developing resilience. So how can people develop that resilience to external opinions and build that stronger sense of self-worth that isn't dependent on the validation of others?
Great question. And before I answer it, is that some corporates are doing a great job here. And yeah, one of my most important and most respected clients is Microsoft. And so I've been fortunate to work with Satya Nadella and his senior leadership team and, call it 60% of their workforce. So it's somewhere around 150,000 of their workforce. They're deeply investing in the psychological skills during work hours so that people can meet the demands of the stressful environment they work in. They are making a radical commitment. And there are companies like this. So I hope your community, folks that are leading or have a position of leadership and or are, managing or are actually on the front line, that they are recognizing that world's best are figuring out this solution. And if your company's not going to provide it, make an investment yourself in it. And it's an investment of time more than it is money at this point. And so I just want to just call that out, that it is happening and we need to take care of ourselves. If our business isn't going to do it for us, we need to take care of ourselves. Okay. So to your question about resilience, I think we simply need to recognize that you are worthy exactly as you are. You are not your grade, whether that's an A or an F. You are not your job. You are not your age. You are not your marathon time. You are not your place on the org chart, your relationship status, your gold bars, or your prison bars. Like, that's not who you are. You have an inherent value and it is not conditioned on anything that you've done. That's where the trap is. So it's not conditioned by how virtuous you have been or how many mistakes that you've made. Your virtue and your failures are not factored into the calculus of your value as a human being. Your value stems from your being, not your doing. So how do we work with the resilience and building resilience? Is it starts with a deep, rich understanding and a commitment that I value because I breathe. I value because I'm here. That's where my value comes from. And I'm leaning into my very best ability and I'm doing my very best. And I'm trying to figure it out. So when something doesn't go well, it's not a referendum on my identity. It's an opportunity for me to learn from it. And unfortunately, where the stress of where resilience starts to break down. Okay, hold on. As I said, what I just said, people at their core go, yeah, I know all that. Yeah. That sounds nice. Yeah. I know that. That's of course. But then what ends up happening is when they are about to walk on a stage or do something public or are in a job interview, say, is that they start to tighten up, and they tighten up because they haven't fully committed that I fucking matter because I'm here and I'm trying and thank you and I'm in it with you, as opposed to, don't blow it. Don't look stupid. Don't let people down. People are counting on you. All of that is about your identity. It's about a reflection of how well you do something is the equation to who you are. That will never hold up. And that is why, whether it's in big sport or business or intimacy in life, in relationships, is that what ends up taking, the reason we feel like it's a fight, flight, freeze mechanism that is the origin of that, you know, readiness to attack or readiness to run away, is to save your life.
Yeah.
Why would that show up on stage? Why would that show up? Because your identity is matched and fused with how well you do something. So it feels like your entire identity is at stake. It feels like your sense of self is at risk. That's why the fight, flight, freeze mechanism shows up. That's the only reason it shows up. Because if you are able to do exactly what I just said, that you are not your job, your age, your marathon time, you are not that. You are so much deeper. When you go on stage, you're free. When you really embrace that, and I'll share a wisdom that was passed to me about 20 years ago. Mike, are you a puddle or the ocean? I said, what do you mean? Well, are you more like a puddle or the ocean? I said, oh, I'm the ocean. Yeah. And my mentor says to me, you act like the puddle. I go, what do you mean? He says, well, something goes wrong and it's like somebody jumped in your puddle, displaced all your water, and it's not that big of a deal, but you act like it's like the end of like everything. So be more like the ocean. Practice being like the ocean, because you're acting like you're just the puddle. And that changed me. And that changed me in a way that maybe somebody or, you know, in your community listening, like, how do I become more like the ocean? You can drop anything in the ocean. It's not easily displaced. My friend with two big feet jumps in my puddle and it's like, I'm a mess.
I was just going to say, how do you go about doing that though? Like you're in this puddle, or you think you're the ocean, but you're really the puddle. You're acting like the puddle, even though you want to be the ocean. How do you go about making those steps to transform into that ocean?
So all those directional notes that I just talked about, like you are so much more than what you do, that's how you do it. So you spend time getting to the essence and the truth of who you are. And what ends up happening, so one of the ancient practices of meditation is it's a contemplative process, which is you're just basically following the thought stem. And the thought stem, so you sit down, you relax, you do a couple breaths, you know, close your eyes if you feel comfortable, and you're just kind of in that, trying to settle your mind down. And you just follow this thought stem. Who am I? And when I ask you right now, Nick, like, how do you answer that? Who am I? What would you say?
Man, I am a guy who has fun serving others.
Okay, good. So you go to role, right? Mm-hmm. And then so you go, I'm a guy who loves serving others. And then maybe you'll go, who am I? And you're thinking about, I said guy, that's interesting. So identify with being male, huh?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Who am I? Male? I don't know. So you keep going. Who am I? Well, I'm a son. I'm a father. I am a spouse. Wait, I'm more than that. Who am I? I'm a sports psychologist. Wait, keep going. Who am I? And you very quickly get past role or position in life. You get past presentation. And you get to that quiet recess that is left unexamined for many of us. Like, who the fuck am I? Sorry, bleep that out if this is not a mature a conversation here, but like, who am I? Who am I really? And so you follow that for, let's say, 10 minutes. And that's your only job, to explore who am I. And each time your mind wanders to all the things that you've got to do, or like your left butt cheek has fallen asleep and you're attending to that. You know, like you just keep refocusing back to the question, who am I? And it is exhaustive. It is real work. And eventually you get to a deep understanding, like I'm more like the ocean. I don't even know how to describe it, but it is never going to be enough for me to have a label of like what I wear, what I do, what I drive, you know, how good I do anything that I do. That stuff's going to fall really short. So it's a practice. Meditation would be the first one. Mindfulness practice would be the first. And again, conversations with people of wisdom is an accelerant. And of course, journaling, if you like that as a practice as well.
Yeah. So let's touch on that kind of round table of trusted advisors of whose opinion you said kind of matter, or of course matter. How do people identify and cultivate such a supportive network in their life to have that round table of peers?
So in the book, we talk about, you know, the essence is stop worrying about what people think of you and how to get free from that. And again, I want to say, this is not about not caring. It's knowing whose opinion you care. And so I just needed like a visual. I'm a visual person. So this idea of a round table, and for me, there was 8 chairs. And this is not easy to do because you are excluding a lot of people that you know. Dr. Robin Dunbar, you know, did some research and he found that just about everybody has about 150 people that there's a relationship where if we were to see each other in Ireland by off chance and each of us have 150 people in our network, that would say, Nick, oh my God, like Nick, oh my God, great, wild to see you here. And, you know, and then we would know something about each other and da, da, da. So there's about 150. So I'm saying boil that down to 8. And of the 8, these are the people's opinions that really matter to you. And what is the criteria to get to that table of 8? It can be anything you want it to be. But for me, it's a 2-vector criteria. The first is they have demonstrated deeply, time under tension, that they care. They care about who I am. They care about my traumas. They care about my vision of who I want to become. They've invested and they care. So when they give a bit of advice or an opinion or weigh in on something, they're giving it in context to my struggles and my ambitions, my dreams and my traumas. So it's not just flippant, you know, intelligent advice or opinion. It's something that's in context. So it's that. So that's the first vector. The second vector is that they have had to have done something in the amphitheater of risk or pressure or stress. So they know what it's like to operate under stressful conditions, because that's the world that I'm spending my time in. It's the essence of my craft. So it's those 2 vectors, and that's kind of what allows them to be on the in my roundtable. And like, there's not everyone has equal value on both. Like, that's a little bit of a sliding scale. Some people, it's like an 80-20. 80, they've invested in me, but only 20% value of like, they know the amphitheater, but they've got some understanding of it. So anyways, those are the 2 ways that I think about it. And I think it's a great intellectual, emotional exercise. And it's a little scary because maybe your closest uncle doesn't make it. Maybe you're fill in the blank, you know, person that, you know, you think is supposed to be there, like a parent or somebody, like, doesn't make it. And so that part is hard, but I think it is, it's an exercise that's worth doing, because now you know when you're off balance or you're uncertain or you feel like a puddle, that you go to those 8 and you're like, hey, I got something, or one of those 8 at least. And you say, can I pull up? I got something I got to work through with you. And they also become this imaginary counsel, because maybe you can't get in touch with them on the spot, but this is borrowed from that idea, like WWJD. And it was, do you remember those wrist brands that was yep. were around in the 80s? Like, what would Jesus do? It's kind of like, you know, what would fill in the blank person on your council do? And so it's a fun way to think about it. And certainly you could put Jesus on your council. That's cool. You know, there's lots of people that you can put there. They don't have to be alive, but right. It is kind of nice when you can actually physically talk to somebody.
Yeah, that is, I love that. Maybe it's a, There's such power in that too, because you are absolutely vulnerable and it isn't uncomfortable. And the conversations that you're potentially having, hopefully you're having with those people. The more discomfort that I've had in my life equaled more growth, because I've humbled myself in those moments. And I said, I don't know everything, or I'm struggling with this, and I need to lean on others, and not on just on my own understanding, because I can't figure this out on my own, or I want to grow faster than I can, and maybe I'm just not ready for it. So there's a lot of power to that. So I appreciate that. Maybe it's what would your roundtable do? Maybe you need to create.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I love that. That is awesome. Nick, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
Do you recognize FOPO in your life, and like this worry about how you're going to be perceived by other people? Is that something that rings true for you as well?
Yeah, well, let me give you a great example. So when I started this podcast, I got 330 some episodes in. I would say the first 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 episodes, if I'm being honest, like, it was uncomfortable. I can talk to you when I'm face to face. I can talk to you on Zoom, but the perception was this thing was going to get recorded and this thing was going to get out in public. And immediately, what would people think? And what happens if they don't like it? Man, I don't like the sound of my voice when it comes out in the recording. And what happens if I don't ask the right question? What happens if I'm not prepared, or it doesn't come out right, or nobody listens? And so there was a lot of that. The first few handful, 20 episodes, I would finish the podcast episode and I'd walk upstairs and my armpits would be sweaty. And I'm like, this is stupid. Like, this is not who I am. And I just need to change and enjoy the process. And if I kept doing that, the world stopped, or the podcast stopped on average at episode number 7. And maybe that's why. Maybe they just need to get past that hump of just getting in the reps. The more that I did it, and the more I look back at the tape, you think of professional athletes, they always look at their tape, especially the specialized. You think of the NCAA just picked the top four people to be in the playoffs. You know, all of these top athletes have these individual coaches. If it's a kicker, the wide receiver, the nose guard, they all have these individual coaches, and they all look at tape. I finally got uncomfortable and I started looking at my own tape. And the more I started looking at my tape, the realized that I said ums and ahs, you didn't know, my questions were weak, and I wasn't really enjoying the process. So, answer the question, absolutely.
Yeah, that's cool. So I was with the Seattle Seahawks for 9 seasons, and there was like 6 to 8 like absolute heavyweights on the team, that they were the quote unquote stars of the team. And one of them, it was third year, and it was a hallway conversation. And, you know, it was a simple question, like, how you doing, you know? And he was going through some serious heckling from the community, from the fan base, because he wasn't performing all that great. And he said, you know, this has really crushed me. And because I'm trying to do my best, and it's just not kind of working out the way that anyone wants it. But I was so frustrated, and I figured something out, Mike, is that they love you when you perform well, and they'll turn right away when it doesn't go the way that they want it to go. So the idea that they're fickle is what he was pointing to, they meaning others. And he just kind of paused and he said, I'm not listening anymore. And I thought, that's it. So that's once you get to a place where you really meet yourself based on some sort of suffering and pain that you're experiencing, do you have that type of like honest commitment to do it differently? Whether it's sweating through your pits on episode, you know, 1 through 14, let's say, or it's the 80,000 people booing you, or like on social media, the millions kind of snickering or like blaming you, that this is the pro athlete, that at some point, in our lives, it's just too much. And I think many of us are really close to that. And hopefully that's what this book does. It's like, if you see yourself in worrying too much about what people think of you, there's a whole set of practices on how to work from the inside out, how to be free, how to stand in yourself, you know, and be a great contributor to the whole, to other people's lives. There's some really clean practices to increase that. And so I'm glad that you see it. You feel it too. I don't feel as alone.
Yeah, I think the more honest conversations we have with ourselves, the more honest conversations we can have with others. I think the world, if you walk into a grocery store and somebody says, "Hey, Michael, how are you?" And immediately the first reaction is, "Yeah, I'm good. Hey, how are you?" But reality is there is a chance, a probability that something's not going according to plan, or the kid has a D minus in science, or you're having an argument with your spouse, or work's not going according to plan, or you're working too many hours. So I think that we just need to be more honest and have more genuine conversations to get back to the truth, instead of just walking through the mundane and still being in the whirlwind.
I think that reflexive, "Good, how are you?" is dangerous, and it serves a purpose. And so knowing, like, if they're on one of your eight, then it's like, oh, we got to talk.
Yeah.
They could be right on the outside of the eight. And that's probably a person that maybe there's another kind of, I don't know, 30 people on the outside of the table. They're not the inner sanctum, but they're close, you know? It's like, those are the people in those moments that you would say, I want to give you an honest answer, but I know we're in the grocery store. And it's just enough of a tell. Like, if they really care, they'll say, "Whoa." And if they don't really care, or they're busy or whatever, they'll go, "Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, hard times, huh?" And as they're kind of going to pick up the next piece of fruit that they're buying. So you can check, you know, there's ways to check with people as well. And so anyways, I appreciate that thought as well.
I think let's end it there. I think the one for my listeners, just so I could talk to them for a minute, if you want to learn more about what this fellow's up to, and, you know, listen to his podcast, Finding the Mastery, the book, The First Rule of Mastery, and of course, the course, Finding Your Best, which we'll all include in the show notes. But, you know, I think there's a lot to be said of just being fully present with yourself, being honest with yourself, having gratitude, having resilience, working through that process, and enjoying where you're at, and then just doing your best, right? At the end of the day, you can't do any more than that. So it's been a pleasure, Michael, and wishing your book nothing but success.
I appreciate you. Thank you, Nick.